You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for your patience. This is an event on challenging ethnic profiling in Europe. We're going to proceed with some discussion with our two guests, and then we'll have some time for open discussion involving yourselves thereafter. We're very pleased to have here Rosalind Williams, who is an African-American artist and photography curator who's originally from San Francisco, California, but who moved a long time ago to Spain in Europe and encountered very interesting things while she was there. As she will describe, experienced a case of racial profiling by the police in 1992 and took her case to court, and we'll describe what happened. Rachel Neal, to my immediate left, is the senior advisor on ethnic profiling and criminal justice and policing for the Open Society Justice Initiative. Rachel is a renowned expert on not only ethnic profiling, but more generally on comparative policing practices around the world, and has served as an expert to a number of intergovernmental and non-governmental bodies. So I'd like to, my name is Jim Goldston, and I'm the director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, which is part of the vast array of OSI programs. Rosalind, if I can ask you just to describe initially what happened on the day that led to the case that that we're all here to talk about.
Actually, it occurred on December 6, 1992. Which December 6th in Spain is, since Spain became a democratic nation, the day in which the Constitution is celebrated. It's called the Día de la Constitución. So, to be very brief, my husband, my son, and I were traveling by train to Valladolid, which is about 2 hours north of Madrid. And once we arrived at the train station, I got off the train at one end and my husband at the other because he was gathering our luggage. And as I descended, a gentleman came up to me, plain clothes, attractive, tall, and asked me for my identification. In other words, in Spain, every citizen of Spain is required by law to carry a national ID card, which I have. Spanish nationality by marriage as of 1968. And I always carry my ID card with me, and I travel when I leave Spain, and when I enter Spain, I enter and leave on a Spanish passport as a Spanish citizen. So this gentleman asked me for my ID, and I immediately, as a natural response, very quickly looked to the left and to the right, and I immediately saw that he wasn't asking anyone else, and I asked him why. Which I think, parenthetically, I have to say, sort of surprised him. My husband at this point came up to me, and I told my husband that this gentleman is asking me for my ID. And my husband said, why? And he said, because we're looking for people like her. And my husband, both of us at the same time, what do you mean like her? And my husband said, because of the color of her skin, and he said yes. So at that point, we said we would offer him our identification cards, but we would require or request that he also supply us with his badge number. And this is exactly what happened. This interchange took place. And the next day, we went to a local police station, filed a complaint. And with the complaint, we went to a local newspaper journalist, and from that time on, there was an article published in the local newspaper in Valladolid. And once we were back in Madrid, it was a four-day weekend.
Let me just stop you there. Now, at that time, this was 1992, you had been living in Spain for how long?
I've been living in Spain since 1968, do the math.
And had something like this happened to you before?
Never.
And how did you feel at the moment, or once you had a little bit of time to digest the incident?
In the actual moment, I was surprised. I was surprised. I was stunned. And we were on our way, actually, to a family gathering with my husband's family. So I didn't really think too much about the incident. But that evening, I started to think about it, and I really thought I had to do something. So I didn't know what, but I called a friend who she was bureau chief for Associated Press for Spain and Portugal, explaining the incident. And she was the one who suggested that I call the journalist.
You know, when you say you felt like you had to do something, I wonder if you can explain why you felt you had to do something. And I say that in light of the following. When the Open Society Justice Initiative embarked on our work with respect to ethnic profiling in Europe, which Rachel will describe in a bit, one of the questions that I received from a number of other human rights actors in Europe was, gee, that sounds interesting, but why are you focusing your scarce resources on that problem? It's not torture, it's not murder, it's not disappearances, it's something that shouldn't happen, but is it among the worst things in the world? And we've generally had to confront that kind of sentiment as we've been doing some of this work. And so I'm just curious, when you say you felt that you had to pursue this, why did you feel you had to pursue this?
I think I felt I had to pursue it because as a citizen of Spain, I totally, from the very first moment, questioned the constitutionality of having your ID checked or being separated to be identified based on either ethnicity or some racial aspect. I just, in my heart, thought that it was wrong constitutionally. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think if in essence, Spain, since the death of Franco, which was in 1975, was at that time, had at that particular time in EU history, had the most modern constitution in Europe. How on earth, if you have a modern constitution, you can, a country can legally identify and separate people? So I didn't know exactly what I could do, but I thought just to question the constitutionality had to be done one way or another.
Right. And so you pursued your complaint, as you suggested, and you took it through the court system and eventually went up to the Spanish Constitutional Court. Is that right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In other words, as of 1992, we sought through friends who are attorneys, legal assistance, an attorney who was a specialist in constitutional law. And this particular person took the case through various courts throughout Spain, well, all in Madrid, but through various levels. And each time it was thrown out, we always appealed. And contrary to the United States, there's no American civil, or the equivalent of the Civil Liberties Union, so this, nor it was this the work pro bono, so we had to actually fund it out of personal resources. But at the same time, both my husband and I felt that it was important to take it as far as we could. And in between 1992 and 2001, when, as you just said, it ended in the Constitutional Court, it was thrown out of right. that as well.
Right. And my understanding is that the Constitutional Court didn't just throw it out summarily. They issued a judgment, a well-reasoned written judgment that was quite extensive, that explicitly said that race or physical appearance is an appropriate criterion upon which police, law enforcement officials can rely in determining who is and who is not a national of Spain. Right?
Exactly.
And because the reasoning is, people who are nationals of Spain look one way, and that's it. And
exactly.
Yeah. So, what happened after the Constitutional Court quite frontally rejected the merits of your claim?
At that time, it was obvious that we had exhausted all possibilities of any type of legal action in Spain, and therefore knew if anything was to be done, it had to be taken out of Spain. So it was a question of investigating which courts would have been the proper ones. And at that point, since this had been rather costly, and for a series of other circumstances, I was really a bit downtrodden and wasn't too enthusiastic about investigating. Therefore, the obvious court might have been Strasbourg and the European Union, but that had a deadline of 6 months after the last decree. Therefore, as time passed until between 2001 and 2004, periodically I would give lectures and presentations at universities in Spain. In Madrid, where different university professors would ask about the case, because little by little it was very well known and studied in law schools and different sociology classes, human rights, etc. And one of these professors, a professor who was working in Madrid at Syracuse University's program, chose to put me in contact with Open Society, Justice Initiative, and Women's Link Worldwide.
Right.
And from that point, that's when we entered into conversations and actually discussed what the steps would be.
Right. And so eventually you went then to the United Nations Human Rights Committee, which is a treaty body of the United Nations, which is mandated to oversee state compliance with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the committee rendered its views last year, and essentially found the Constitutional Court of Spain had erred, and found that that race is not an appropriate criterion for any government officials to be using, particularly the police, in the context of official business. And how did it feel for you when the Human Rights Committee rendered its views on the case?
Actually, I received an email from Indira Gorris from your organization, and I was shocked. I was extremely elated and extremely surprised, because by this time I knew it was proceeding, et cetera, and from time to time I would ask, how is the case going? What is happening? But I was totally surprised, very, very, very surprised, and very happy, mm-hmm. very happy.
Mm-hmm. And what, if anything, has happened since the views were issued? Have you had contact with the Spanish government? What has the government done in response to that?
Well, the actual committee, the views or the suggestions that the committee put forth toward the government in a certain period of time. The government had to implement certain steps, as it were, and one was to offer me a public apology for what had been done. The second important point was to see that there was some form of reparation. And the third point was to, on the part of the government, to find out or to at least put into place measures that would allow that what had happened to me, the type of incident that occurred, would never happen again. To answer your question, this period was a six-month period, 180 days, which expired more or less around the 23rd of January. To make a very, very long story short, there hasn't been a public apology. New laws are being formulated on a drawing board, but they haven't yet been put into effect, and reparation has not been made. To go into detail, yet the Spanish government, on the part of extremely high-level officials, have gone to the trouble to try to do something. Therefore, the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Cooperation had his chief of staff call me and schedule a personal meeting with him, with four other authorities under his auspices, and formally offered me an apology on the part of the government. but yet it was in a private meeting in his main meeting room. The second in charge of the Ministry of the Interior, which is the equivalent here in the United States of the Homeland Security, also had his first advisor call me and schedule a meeting, just three of us, and in his private meeting room office, and also offered an apology, and went into detail about the new laws that are being formulated, but have not yet gone to Parliament. And as far as the reparation is, then also I received a letter from the Minister of the Interior, so that's the equivalent of Homeland Security, very, very polite, very cordial, very complete letter offering me his apology on the part of the Spanish government, and also elaborating in detail the laws that would eventually, hopefully, go into effect.
So the government has hardly ignored the decision. You've gotten some pretty high-level responses.
Exactly.
But it's not everything.
Exactly.
To date, there's been no public acknowledgement of what's happened,
exactly.
And there's been no offer of reparations yet. And we have yet to see concrete steps of how the practices will be changed in the future to avoid this. Is that right?
Exactly.
Now, Rachel, can I ask you... is what happened to Rosalynn Williams, based on the work that you and colleagues have been doing, unusual?
No, not at all. We've got a report here, which is was published last May, Ethnic Profiling in the European Union, which sets out these practices in a lot of detail. I would say that, unfortunately, what happened to Rosalynn is the common reality across Europe in all countries where visible minorities reside, and an increasing number of European countries are becoming much more diverse on top of the countries that have long-standing immigration. And we started this work in 2005, inspired by Rosalynn's story, which really brought to our attention what a big issue this is in continental Europe and how little attention had been paid to it by domestic civil rights groups. We started by doing research. One of the problems with this area is outside the UK, where there is data gathered by police that includes ethnicity. In the rest of Europe, there is no data about ethnicity and very little data about police practices such as stop and search is put out at all. Just to say that everywhere where we have managed in our own research to gather quantitative data, we have found that visible minorities are disproportionately stopped by police, between three times more than white ethnic indigenous populations, up to as high as 14 times more likely to be stopped. In some cases, we've managed to get what's termed hit data. That is, how often does the police action produce the detection of an infraction or an offense? In no case, with one extremely limited exception, have we found that the people, the minorities being stopped, were offending more often. They were either equal to the indigenous population or far less in some cases. So the stereotypes that go around associating minorities with offending are just flat out wrong. I think a real problem, and one that goes very much back to Rosalynn's case, is that in the current moment, a combination of sort of counter-terror anxieties and economic recession have really driven a surge in anti-immigrant feeling. And we see a number of countries at the moment who are deliberately and explicitly in their policies calling on police to target immigrants for detention and deportation, and this is driving an even larger disproportionality in stop and search practices.
Now, there has been, of course, great attention to the problem of racial profiling in the United States. Until quite recently, there really had not been very much attention to this issue in at least many parts of Europe. And I'm curious as to why you think this is so, either of you, and how these issues play out differently in Europe from how they play out in the United States?
Well, I think I can't really compare and contrast simply because it hasn't. I've been living for the last 40 years in Spain, and even though for work I come back and forth, I come for very specific experiences, work, assignments, etc. But in Spain, well, I can speak for Spain itself. There's not really the it's not really a conscientious attitude of racism as we might perceive here. In other words, you're seen as someone who is different and different from the homogenous society, say in a place like Spain. Up until 10 years ago, there were hardly any, say, non-white Spaniards in the population itself. Therefore, you have an onslaught of immigrants. And even though immigrants are, this is an example, when the Constitutional Court ruled against my, I received the decree, I called the court itself and spoke with asked to speak with one of the judges who had voted against the ruling, in which he had voted in my favor. And he explained to, I called him to say, I'm awfully sorry for what happened, as you can well imagine, but I'm very grateful for your vote. And then he went into great detail to tell me how he had tried to convince the other judges. And he said, he gave an example. He said, presume we're all in Barcelona, and we walk from one end of Las Ramblas, which is a major thoroughfare in Barcelona, and there are two people walking. One is from North Africa, and the other is from Eastern Europe. Policemen come along, as he went on to say, and who are they going to stop? He asked the judges. And then they didn't answer, but he said they would more than likely stop the North African, and the Eastern European would be allowed to continue. Therefore, the judges themselves, or the point I'd like to make, as in Spain, usually they just don't get it. They don't understand. So it's not as if it was conscientious racism. They just want to apart. They don't know how to deal with it, actually. And it's overwhelming. But yet, as we pointed out, it's increasing. Since even though I myself have not been stopped and asked for my ID as I was in 1992, I have been stopped in my car, for example. But and I know other people who were stopped. I've seen it happen on the street, so it's occurring more and more and more every day.
Rachel, as someone who has some experience in the United Kingdom but has lived in the United States and has worked in Europe, do you have any sense about how these issues play out differently in these different places?
A huge question, Jim. I think there's a specific dynamic in the United States. We actually had an event here a little while ago, and the issue of police discrimination is certainly a very deep and long-standing one, particularly in the South. But the issue of racial profiling per se really burst on the scene with the idea that you could have a drug courier profile. And it was an explicit profile, and the DEA actually trained local police forces in applying it. And it was about people of color in rented cars on highways, particularly I-95, going from Florida up through the Eastern Corridor. That was the profile that led to some of the first successful litigation in the case of Robert Wilkins versus the Maryland State Police. The tricky thing in the U.S., is that you have to demonstrate intent. So the fact that there was a profile, that the police were intentionally stopping people on the basis of this profile, enabled that court case to go through.
Intent to discriminate.
Intent to discriminate, sorry. Yeah. In Britain, and here again, there are similarities with the U.S., the issue really burst onto the public consciousness in 1982 after riots in the South London borough of Brixton. That was following very, very heavy-handed police use of what were called sus laws, stop and search laws. There was an operation in the area, and they had gone through and just stopped massive numbers of young kids and were doing pat-downs on them constantly. And the degree of frustration and humiliation and kind of powerlessness, I think, that the youth felt just exploded And there's the famous Clash song, London's Burning, which is all about that. Now, I think what was interesting in the UK is that a little later this resulted in some changes in law which codified the requirement that police track all stop and search and fill out a form which includes not just the details about the name and so on of the person stopped, but their ethnicity and the result of that stop and search. And that's done to this day, although police are pushing back against it quite hard at the moment. So in the UK, unlike America, you've got national data. What's disturbing, I think, is that national data has not been productively put into managerial practices that have managed to bring down disproportionality. In some forces, this has been done, and there's some really interesting good practice about how you can use information to manage the use of police powers and indeed to have a conversation with the community about how they're policed. Mm. There's some great stuff going on, but unfortunately, it's very patchy and isolated. And how one scales that up and takes information and awareness into actual change of practice, I think, is something that's very stubbornly resistant. Mm. I think in America, and maybe this is, in America you don't have systematic national data gathering. Mm. A lot of data gathering has come out of litigation efforts, and there tends to be a very adversarial stance then between the police and between the civil rights groups. And there are some interesting efforts going on with activists in this country now, sort of saying we've got to get beyond this finger pointing of you're racist, no, we're not racist, it's crime. We have to move this again into how do we change practice, how do we have a different way of talking about and going about policing our communities.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I wonder if one big difference as well is that in the United States, although profiling has a long history, it in the modern era, it became a national issue only after several decades in which race as such was an important political issue in the United States. I mean, after centuries, but certainly decades after Brown had been decided and put race on the national agenda for a long time. Whereas in Europe, outside of the United Kingdom and Ireland, there really has not been much of a discussion about race and ethnicity as such in most continental European countries until very, very recently, when these countries are confronting greater heterogeneity, and both from immigration and from other sources. And so profiling is arising as just one of a number of manifestations of race and ethnicity as live issues in these societies, all of which are very new. And the European legal construct is in very much in evolution. So it's only in the last 10 years that we have seen significant developments at the European level, which have made clear that discrimination in all spheres, including in the area of policing, but in all spheres of public life on grounds of race or ethnic origin, is unlawful. And it's only even more recently that actors, activists, lawyers are trying to transform these new norms into practice. So it's all so new, the discussion, the activity in Europe, that I think that's a big difference as well.
I'd like to add something based on what you're saying, is that in the main contrast with the United States is that in essence, well, again, I'm speaking for Spain, there's no real civil rights movement. There's no leader. Therefore, not only are the powers that be, the different ministries, taken aback by what is happening, and specifically in relation to this case, are even more, I would say, embarrassed. Because over and over again, I was told in these different meetings that I explained, they said, you realize Spain isn't what it was 17 years ago. You realize Spain, and I said, I agree, but yet something has to be done. And then the other thing that's very important to realize is that Europeans, or at least Spaniards, hardly ever have any contact with other races. You know, the whole immigrant population is so very new, as you pointed out. It's maybe 10, 12, 15 years. And it's not as if here you would have different ethnicities or different races in different professional levels, et cetera. That's not the case at all in Spain. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I do want to qualify my comment anyway about the newness of this and the newness of the diversity in populations, because, of course, Roma populations have been in European societies for hundreds of years as brutally oppressed racial and ethnic minorities, and they have only recently been acknowledged as full members of society, are still struggling very much for that full membership. But certainly with respect to immigration, that seems to be a more recent phenomenon. Did you want to add something on this?
I want to note that, I mean, there are countries in Europe that have pretty long-standing, certainly into the third-generation migration, Britain, France, and also the Netherlands and Germany. In some of those cases, such as the Netherlands, Germany, people were viewed as guest workers, and there was this strange assumption that they'd go home at some point, which by the time of the third generation, one has to wonder. And I think it's incredibly difficult for the youth coming out of those environments now to deal with the fact that they're still regarded as outsiders, and there are terms in Dutch and German of sort of the national and the outsider. That are used in these discussions, which are just very humiliating, I think, for those folks. In France, you have a very particular dynamic as well, where the French are very wedded to their idea of constitutional equality, which at one level is wonderful and is great, but at another level, because of that, they refuse to recognize racial or ethnic difference officially. No, we're all French. Once you're French national, you're French, and you're all equal. But it's a very formal legal equality, and if you go to France and you try to figure out what's going on, there's very great discrimination in the education, housing, other systems, but there's no official data on that because they won't collect data on different ethnicities. One of the reasons, of course, is the legacy of the Second World War, and the reasons people are sensitive about classifying people ethnically. But without those kinds of statistics, you cannot look at patterns of practice in different policies that are discriminating against groups of people. And so we've been arguing against this attitude that ethnic data is unlawful or possibly dangerous, and to say that we have to have statistics, not personal ethnic data, but statistics to understand what's happening and then address it.
Do you want to say, in addition to the need for data statistics, what else has to happen in order to transform these practices in European societies, and what are some of the things that we and partners are doing to make that possible?
Yeah, I think there are really three areas of action. I mean, first, we just need recognition of this issue. We need a definition of it, and we really need norms that explicitly recognize and prohibit discriminatory policing practices. There is some movement towards that at a European level, not in terms of legal norms, but in terms of certain actions by non-discrimination bodies and case law from the European Court of Human Rights. Secondly, we need information, we need public awareness. We need to understand clearly what is going on, why it's happening, and what's driving it, because without that, we can't craft the right kind of policies to address it. And we've been trying to work to identify good practices. We've done some research across Europe on good practices that are going on, and there are things. They're somewhat isolated, and there's not a regional dialogue going on about them yet, but we're trying to encourage that. And we did also do a project where we cooperated directly with police and with local communities in three countries. And we had assistance from the British Home Office and London Metropolitan Police and Leicestershire Constabulary. And we introduced stop forms. It was challenging. The one area where we got our best results, however, I think really demonstrated what can be done when there's goodwill and when you're informed by solid evidence of what's going on. Here, the police reduced the number of stops they were doing by half,
But the number of those stops that actually produced a hit, a law enforcement outcome, went up 3 times. They were much more efficient when they were required to think about who they were stopping and why. Also, and critically from this conversation, the disproportionality, the number of times they were stopping immigrants and ethnic minorities, went down very significantly. It didn't vanish, but it went down a lot. And finally, of course, in cases where we can't cooperate and promote good practice, I think we need to find avenues to take legal action and to show clearly that this is illegal discrimination, and that governments need to be pushed to stop it if they won't do it of their own accord.
And just before we open it up for discussion, we've been talking primarily about profiling in the ordinary policing context, and that is the situation really in which Rosalind's case arose. But I think we found that profiling, it manifests itself as well in counterterrorism practices as well. Do you want to say a little bit about how that happens?
Yes. And this is an area, I have to say, I think more research could be warranted in the United States as well. This report, again, the one I mentioned before that came out last June, one of the thing's main goals was to look specifically at how, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in this city, but also the March 11th attacks in Madrid and the July 7th attacks in London, the police were using religious and ethnic and national origin stereotypes to target counterterrorism. We looked at a series of practices from mass ID checks outside mosques, stop and search under counterterror powers, the use of surveillance and monitoring, raids on Muslim places of business and mosques, even arrests under kind of conspiracy type laws in France. And finally, the notion of radicalization, something that here, with Jihad Jain being arrested last week, I think becomes much more relevant. But this is the notion that you can have the quote-unquote homegrown terrorist, people who, for whatever reasons, become so alienated that they will actually turn to violent extremism. And there have been efforts to come up with a series of specific criteria that you can train police and indeed educators and other social workers in to identify persons who may be at risk of radicalization and then take actions to try to deter them. We've been really disturbed to find that both in this area and all the other powers that I just mentioned, there has been a great tendency to target religion or the nature of religious practice rather than base actions on concrete and actionable intelligence about evidence of support, active support for terrorism or planning an attack. I think this is deeply worrying because when you look carefully across the different terror attacks that have happened, if you look at the experts who are writing this, there is uniform agreement that there is no terrorist profile. To base your law enforcement actions on a profile then invites evasion and substitution. It invites the terrorists to get people who do not fit the profile then to try to carry out other attacks. So I think that just as in ordinary law enforcement, profiles in terrorism and counterterrorism are stereotypes. They are very frequently inaccurate and therefore they're ineffective and dangerous to our security.
Okay. Please, you have another comment. Sure.
I'd just like to add just two slight things. One is that in Spain also it's they're using the profiling right now for both counterterrorism and immigration. Mm-hmm. Both. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I wanted to add the way, say, from the part of view of the public, I think and I've mentioned this there inside the country, I think the Ministry of Education must come into play simply so that children and children as they go through the school systems really become aware, based on the fact that Spain has been a democratic nation for such a short period of time, right, for only 30 years, that people need to learn what their rights are, their rights and their privileges and their responsibilities, mm-hmm, as citizens in a democratic society.
Great, thank you. Let's open it up for comments from the floor, and I think there'll be microphones which we would ask you to use. Sir, please, at the back.
Is this on? Yeah. Joel Sachs from the Juilliard School. There's been a little unintended spin-off of the experience you had. Apparently in Spain, and especially in Barcelona, it's well known that these stops take place. And I've heard of several cases, one of which occurred with Chinese-American friends of mine. They were stopped by two plainclothesmen who insisted on seeing their identification. They pulled out their papers, and the two plainclothesmen ran off with all her papers and all her money. In other words, it's being imitated. Since it's known that the stop and check is common, it's being imitated by thieves. I wonder if I could ask you if any study has been done of the Israeli methods of behavioral profiling, which they use, I guess, at security at the airports.
I wouldn't want to comment on it in Israel because I understand from friends the nature of the problems going on at airports and so on, not more generally there. But yes, there's a very active export by Israeli security and former security personnel of behavioral profiling. Some of it is very interesting, and I was privileged to actually witness some training in Schiphol Airport, not inside the airport. The train station comes right up into the airport, and there's a huge sort of open mass transit area where they're quite worried about attacks. And there was an Israeli company was training the military police who patrol that area in behavioral profiling. They specifically asked us not to sort of publicize a lot of details about what we saw. But I have to say, it was very interesting. It really was focused on looking for abnormal patterns of behavior, and I do think it distracted from a focus on ethnicity. But also, it's such a hard thing to do. You feel some sympathy for the police officers in the environment, sort of looking at hundreds of people going through, all of them with luggage, because they're at an airport, or most of them, and trying to sort of figure out what warrants a stop. But one thing that was very interesting to me about it was part of the exercise required the officers to explain to the people they stopped why they'd done it. This was included both because it reduces a lot of the tension in the encounter, it increases the person who is stopped level of satisfaction, or at least being okay with it. They understand the rationale, so you don't upset people so much. But it also forces the officer to figure out what it is he's watching that's wrong, and really kind of work that through and be much more systematic and engaged in the way that they think about stopping someone. The other interesting thing they said, sorry, and I'll just end with this detail, is that they don't allow officers to go around in pairs or groups. They have to go on their own because otherwise they distract each other.
Yes, comment at the front. And we had a good model of, if you could please identify yourself before you pose a question. Thank you.
Hi, Luisa Rogue. I guess I have a question for all three of you.
And are you with any organization?
No, I'm not. I guess for Rosalind, my question is, how was it covered in Spain? Was there great media on this? Did you stay in contact with some of the journalists?
Yes, there was. There was very, I would say, robust media coverage. Mm-hmm. In other words, during the first, say, 10 or 11 years, the attorney who handled the case, it was a single person, had very significant media contacts. So every time the case was thrown out, he would always see that at one point or another there was some interview in, for instance, in this case in El País, which is the greatest distributed newspaper in the country. And in essence, we would refuse because there were some more sensationalist media that just wanted to jump on it and have me say, oh, all Spaniards are racist, blah, blah, blah. And we just literally filtered that type of information. And when the resolution came out from the Human Rights Committee, there was significant coverage in both national and international press.
And how would you, how could you portray the coverage? What kind of coverage of the decision in the UN?
Well, there was when it came out within the first week, the Sunday edition, a Sunday supplement of the same newspaper, did a front page article and a full page article about it in great detail, and very faithful to actually what had been done. And then about a month or so later, another journalist, always at El País, which is a newspaper that I think, I don't know the exact circulation, but it's not too large circulation for a country like the United States, but for Spain it is, say 3 or 4 million people read it daily. And there was an in-depth study by a journalist of all the different countries that the Human Rights Commission had called attention to for one reason or another, and went into detail about Spain and the times that they had literally not only not paid any attention at all. So in this case has received television coverage. Major Spanish television network has interviewed me 2 or 3 times, as well as the newspapers.
See, that's a big change, and I think Spain is in a very advanced state compared to some other countries, because I remember a little more than a decade ago when we embarked upon Roma rights litigation in a number of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, and we would talk with local council and NGOs about how to use the media and what their impressions of it. There was as much fear of the media as seeing it as a tool for public education, because sometimes you would come back with a European Court of Human Rights judgment finding in favor of the applicant, and the lawyer would be criticized in the press for embarrassing the state, taking all this money, shaming the people of country X or Y. So I think you're in a relatively favorable environment.
I think so. Well, in reality, you're right, because they have actually, since the second article came out with information, journalists have actually sent emails saying that they really wanted to be kept informed. Mm-hmm. Of what is happening. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Other comments or questions? Let's go there, and then we'll come back down.
I'm Indira Gores with the Justice Initiative. Rosalyn, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what has kept you going in the 18 years since you embarked on this legal challenge. You know, this incident occurred in December of 1992, and now it's March of 2010, and we're still fighting to get compliance by the Spanish government. So what is it that keeps you motivated almost 2 decades after the fact? And what factors do you think have played into supporting your decision to challenge this particular incident?
I think there's several factors. One is, as I mentioned before, I feel very strongly about living in a democratic society and being aware of your rights as a citizen. And I really, without being, you know, a crusader, I felt that it was very important on a very low-key level. In other words, even though it's been a long time and it's been very significant each time, maybe there would be a year's interval, 4 months at one time, so it was rather constant. I wasn't really obsessed, let's say. But at the same time, I and the different legal bodies involved were very concerned and very hands-on. And at the same time, this was very, I'm sure perhaps it would happen here as well, every time something would come out in the press, there would be people who would stop me on the street. This is an example. I went one day to buy a lottery ticket at a near office of near my studio, and the person who was selling tickets said, "Oh, you're the person who came out in the newspaper. Oh, congratulations, etc." So you really feel as if you're part of a whole group of people who want something to happen. You know? And then again, as I mentioned earlier, I had support. My husband, who is white and Spanish, was quite active in helping democracy arrive to Spain. And he was very supportive in making sure that whatever I wanted to do, I was allowed to, I did, and he supported it both emotionally, psychologically, and from a financial point of view.
I mean, this case really does seem a true testament to the proposition that one person can really have an amazing impact. No. Other questions? We have one down here, I think.
Hi, my name is Wendy Hong. I'm the founder and the CEO of the Foundation for Global Collaboration and Peace. I actually have a comment, a longish comment, that's in response to what you're asking, Roslyn.
Can you make it a medium comment?
I'll try. The thing is, you had asked about comparative experiences of racism and so forth. So I was born in China. I was raised in the United States. I lived in Paris and lived in London. So that's why it makes a long comment. So when I was graduating high school, asking my accounting teacher what he thought I should major in, he said accounting because there are so many Asian people who I think he actually said Chinese, but it's been a long time, who studied that. So that's an American experience. Another one when I was going to college is that some guy tried to push me down the subway platform, and when the cops came afterwards, he made this sort of slanty eyes thing, pulling the corners of his eyes, and then ran away. And when the police came, when I told them that, one guy actually snickered at that. And he, so that's my wonderful American racism experience. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Paris, it was much more subtle. I remember going to the cafeterias, and the cashier actually turned my cup upside down because that was the way you do it in France. And another not personal experience was my ex is Italian. So when he was there, one of his friends was talking about a quarter in Paris, I think the 13th, that is very tropical, meaning there are a lot of African immigrants or African residents there. And then in London, two experiences. One is that when I was going for jobs after studying there, a lot of disproportionate amount of companies asked me if I wanted to go to China. Like, you know, my Chinese is not very good. I have to actually explain that to them because, you know, they just assumed, and actually my classmates as well just said, why don't you go to China? Because I didn't grow up in China. That's why. The other experience is I was attacked after coming back from an interview to North London, and my attacker was two young African males. And what was really surprising and refreshing was the fact that, besides it was a horrible experience, that they did not use any ethnic slurs, which was really interesting. So it's the positive and the negative experience, you can say. So that's my longish comment. I apologize.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments?
Hi, I'm Harriet Balkind, and I've known Roslyn for many, many years, which is why I'm here. But when you were talking about how racial profiling, actually the true statistics are that it's kind of worthless in terms of predicting any terrorism or any type of event. And I know in this country during the whole torture Bush controversy, there was so much publicity about how, you know, waterboarding and all of that really didn't get you the kinds of results you needed, that I think a lot of Americans actually kind of woke up to the fact that there are other approaches. And I just wondered, has anyone done any publicity about the true fact that racial profiling doesn't result in any valid statistical information?
Other than us.
Well, but a book is one thing. A book is one thing. But honestly, you know, getting on the front page of the New York Times and all of that is something else. Is anybody sort of pushing that so that people really do understand in Western countries that it's kind of a big waste of time and money?
There's quite an active community of people doing that. And there was a very interesting exchange actually in the New York Times by a number of experts recently, right after the administration announced the list of 14 countries based on nationality who would go through extra screening which, if anything, is evadable. And I think the Mike German is a very interesting individual. He's a former FBI agent who works with the ACLU. Mark Sageman is another expert who's written extensively about Al-Qaeda and the nature of the social networks that underlie the structure of organization and how that differs in different places. A place called the Klingendael Institute in The Hague, a gentleman there whose name, Edwin Backer, I think it is, did an analysis of something like 260 individuals who'd been arrested and or charged with terror offences, and concluded that while there was a sort of profile, it was so broad that it included probably half the males in Europe of immigrant origin and therefore was completely useless. So there are, you know, quite a lot of people, and certainly the most expert people out there, tend to be saying this. In the US, there's a very interesting book looking at data mining, which is where you take a profile and you try to do a search through computer databases, which was headed, by a former Secretary of Defense from the Bush administration, whose name I'm blanking on. It's a National Research Council report by a commission of people which concluded that there's absolutely no evidence that data mining functions and that it should not be explored as a counterterrorism tool until there is some kind of proof that it does in fact work. I think the tragedy is that 9/11 and the shock and the fear that terrorism generates has flipped around public opinion in this country and indeed in all of the Western countries, so that if you look at the polling before 9/11, there was a pretty massive consensus in this country. I think it was over 80%, wasn't it? High 80% of people polled said racial profiling was just wrong and needed to be addressed. After 9/11, and I don't know that I've seen any very recent polls, but people felt that profiling was entirely justified in the pursuit of terrorism. So I think we need to fight back against that, both on grounds of principle, but also on simple grounds of this does not make us safer, but particularly to hold on to our principles and not succumb to the kind of attitudes that terrorism tries to engender. Actually, I just want to say one thing about a sort of clarification on the behavioral profiling. Although what I witnessed I thought was very sophisticated and quite impressive, also quite hard to do in practice, I think there's a lot of stuff out there that's being called behavioral profiling, where it's not nearly as subtle, where they're using things like smelling of rose water, or having just shaved a beard, or that are in fact proxies for religion. And we need to be very careful about simply endorsing something called behavioral profiling because it's not ethnic profiling. I mean, I think we need to encourage police officers to be smart, and we do need to help them do the best job they can. They're not exactly in an enviable position with these tasks. But on the other hand, we also need to be able to look very carefully at what they're doing and when, in fact, it is just about stereotypes versus real behavior.
Other comments, questions? The back there.
Hi, I'm John Correa. Are there any legal protections for non-citizens at border controls for profiling?
I can only speak to this in the European Union. Jim may know more broadly. I mean, the inherent nature of crossing a border is that people are distinguished between on grounds of nationality. So on the basis of your passport, and indeed then no. The Schengen Border Code, however, which is what rules governs the free movement area of Europe, in Article 6 explicitly states that border controls cannot be conducted in a fashion that discriminates on the basis of race, ethnicity, religion, gender, and other factors that are not nationality.
Right. And just to add, I mean, generally, under international human rights law, states cannot distinguish between citizens and non-citizens in the enjoyment of most rights, but they can, of course, in the enjoyment of the right to enter a country, to cross a border. But there, it's clear, as just said, that states cannot discriminate in entry on grounds of race or ethnic origin. And there was a case in the United Kingdom, there have been a number, but one that that involved Roma trying to go to the United Kingdom from the Czech Republic, and a monitoring system had been set up by the British authorities in Prague Airport to identify before they got on the plane to London who was Roma and who was not, in order to deny them permission to board. And the case went up to the House of Lords, at that time the highest judicial authority in the United Kingdom, and the court explicitly ruled that it was impermissible to single out people on the basis of race in making that immigration entry decision. Other...
Hi, my name is Amanda Wetzel with the Justice Initiative, and my question is about implementation of racial profiling decisions, both here in the United States, and then what Rachel's view is about the relative willingness of police authorities in European countries to cooperate, both on advocacy positions with regard to racial profiling, and let's say in the future there might be litigation on the issue, and there might be a judgment. In the United States, there have been, very recently articles in the New York Times outlining how the Center for Constitutional Rights had two cases challenging racial profiling in New York City, and the first case was settled. The police department was required to take several steps, one of which included collecting statistics about racial profiling. And in 2009, the statistics reported to the Center for Constitutional Rights indicated that the problem had significantly increased in New York City since their first case, and now their second case is still pending. And I think your example that you gave earlier regarding the very positive implementation of just advocacy in the United Kingdom might be instructive of a greater willingness of police departments in Europe to cooperate and reduce this problem. Or what's your feeling on that?
I think one just simply cannot generalize at all. And there's sort of two distinct factors go on. One is that police don't always make these decisions for themselves. Governments have significant influence over what police do. And when they're told to go and round up X number of immigrants or told to round up Chinese people because they've got a deportation charter flight to China and they really don't want empty seats on it because it costs a lot, the police are kind of like, they go and they round up Chinese people. They're often not at all happy with that. And we've spoken with police unions who have been very articulate about their unhappiness with that. That said, there's also a massive amount of police resistance. I think that there's increasing recognition across different countries that Europe is becoming a diverse region, that they are going to, if they're not more sensitive to these issues, face problems. Everybody remembers the riots in France in November 2005, and those really kind of resonate at some level across the collective consciousness of police. That said, going from this kind of state of anxiety to a willingness to actually recognize publicly and to the people you're doing it to that you've got a problem is a huge step. And it's one that police officers are often really unwilling to do. And then just the depth of the kind of stereotypes that people have is really quite startling sometimes. Actually, outside Barcelona, where we work with the police, we asked them why they were stopping so many Moroccans. And they said, it's well known that Moroccans carry knives. So these are self-defense stops. We have to stop them in the self-defense of the officer. Apart from the fact of why you do a proactive self-defense stop, we looked at the stop forms. We said, look, your hit rate on Moroccans is 3%, and it's not for knives. They're not carrying knives. So why are you stopping them? Well, they carry knives. And it was just a circular conversation, which was very difficult. It takes a long time to sort of sense. On the one hand, the police officers have to be sensitized, and they do have to, at some level, grapple with and get to know the communities that they're policing. But at another level, and most importantly, they have to be told that they mustn't do this. And there has to be some kind of monitoring and accountability for how, in fact, they do use their powers. And I think that's where, if you do gather data as has happened in places in the US and is done on a national scale in the UK, if you don't take that next step with the data, if you don't use it to inform your practice, it just contributes to this kind of sterile finger-pointing exercise. And in much of the UK, for all that there are these very interesting initiatives going on in different places, in much of the UK, the vast bulk of the debate is about available populations. What they're saying is, well, we stop more black people because actually if you go out and you look on these streets in London in these areas, there are more black people on the street available to be stopped than there are white people. Black kids hang out on the street more than white kids, so it's actually not disproportionate, it's proportionate to that population. And you're like, but this doesn't help in the conversation, in the experience of these young people and in what is happening. We have to get beyond that, and we have to sort of look at what actually makes communities safer and what contributes to better relations and more effective policing.
And haven't we seen the example of data being misused or data monitoring and collection being misused in the United Kingdom in the recent judgment of the European Court of Human Rights, which found violative of provisions of the European Convention some of the stop and search provisions? Wasn't there reference made to the fact that in some instances there had been reports of attempts to stop white persons in an effort to balance the data and avoid the showing of a disproportion, even where there wouldn't have been a basis for the stop? I think given the limits of time, we ought to stick with folks who have not spoken. Is there anybody? Okay. You want to go with one more? Let's have a last comment, and then...
Mikey Hicks, which hit the newspapers recently, this kid of 10, I think he is, who's been patted down every time he goes through security since he was 2, because he has the same name as someone on the terror list. Does that suggest that this is being done precisely to avoid legal action and on accusations of prejudicial conduct? In other words, everybody has to be stopped randomly in order to find the people we're looking for, so that we don't get sued for stopping only one type of person. I mean, it seems like a complete absurdity to stop a 2-year-old kid because he has the same name as a terrorist.
Right. Well, I believe the New York City police practices are that there's random stops throughout the New York subway system. And one of the reasons my understanding is that that was adopted was precisely to avoid any allegation that might lead to legal action suggesting that any group was being improperly targeted. So that may lead to some strange results.
But if they stopped him because of his name, it wasn't random. I mean, my husband actually was on a no-fly list briefly because I think he had the same name as somebody from the IRA. I don't know, he's called McCabe. And they'd be like, oh, you know you're on the no-fly list. Here, fill in this form, get on the plane. okay, I feel safer. I mean, one really wonders about some of these lists. And I think what we're very concerned about with those in particular is that people should not get on them because of the discriminatory process that targets them for the wrong reasons. And that, as my husband was given a form to get off it, they should have some kind of recourse. You know, a 2-year-old should, I mean, that's just ludicrous.
They've been trying for 8 years to get him off.
I mean, there's the famous case of Khalid El-Masri, the German national, of course, who crossed over into Macedonia and was picked up by Macedonian authorities and turned over eventually to the United States forces and sent to Afghanistan, where he was mistreated. And then for several months later, he was left in the hills of Albania, and there's been no apology given, and it was the reports indicate that he was picked up because he had the same name as someone else, and that it was an entire mistake. The United States government has yet to acknowledge what happened in that case. So these things do happen.
The terror lists are notoriously problematic to get off them because the information is shared at different levels. It's unclear. And a lot of the recourses at the national level, it's extremely difficult and unclear to figure out how you got on, who put you there, what list you're on in the first place, and get yourself off it. It's a serious issue that needs international attention.
Okay, so I want to thank you all very much for coming. Thank you, Rosalind Williams and Rachel Neild.
Thank you.